Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. All right, folks, I've got a question. How do you know when your users are running into show-stopping bugs? When they complain about you on Twitter? Maybe they're nice enough to open a support ticket? You know, most people won't even bother telling your support about bugs. They'll just suffer through it all instead. And God, don't even get me started about Twitter. Great teams are actually proactive about this. They have processes and tools in place to detect bugs in real time, well before they're frustrating all the customers. Teams from companies such as Twilio, Instacart, and CircleCI rely on Rollbar for exactly this. Rollbar provides your entire team with a real-time feed of application errors and automatically collects all the relevant data, presenting it to you in a nice and easy readable format. Just imagine, no more grepping logs and trying to piece together what happened. Rollbar even provides you with an exact stack trace, linked right into your code base, any request parameters, browser, operating system, and affected users, so you can easily reproduce the issue, all in one application. To sweeten the pot, Rollbar has a special offer for everyone. Visit rollbar.com/realworlddevops, sign up, and Rollbar will give you $100 to donate to an open source project of your choice through opencollective.com. Hi, folks. I'm Mike Julian, your host for the Real World DevOps Podcast. My guest this week is Josh Duty, a good friend of mine and who is also a salary negotiation coach for engineers and author of the book, The Fearless Salary Negotiation. His articles have appeared in Glassdoor.com and any number of other locations. And he's amusingly also been interviewed live on the BBC, which was kind of cool when I found out about that. Josh, I'm just imagining BBC calling you and you're like, oh, shit, like I should probably put some pants on.
I already had pants on. I was at Starbucks I started tweeting back and forth with whoever the producer was. And then within 45 minutes, I was live on the air on international TV on the BBC being interviewed from my office. So that was interesting.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I don't know too many people that say they've been interviewed by BBC live. So
yeah, that's it's a feather awesome. In my cap for sure. It was absolutely a pretty awesome, scary experience, and I'm really glad that it happened as quickly as it did, because I think if I had time to think about what was, you know, the fact that that was going to happen, I could have gotten nervous, but I didn't have time to get nervous. I literally was just scrambling to like get some kind of lighting in my office and make sure my camera was working, you know. So I spent, you know, 20 minutes on logistics, and then I was on, you know, live international television being interviewed on the BBC, and then it was over. 3 minutes later, it was done.
So. It's a lot of work for such a short little time.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you today about salary negotiation, job negotiation, asking for raises, like all this whole gamut. But where I want to start is everyone's favorite topics. Everyone loves a good train wreck. So like, what's your favorite, like, negotiation went totally sideways story?
Well, I was thinking about this before we talked, in case you asked about it. And I'm not sure I can tell you my favorite one. Because the only way I could tell it is if I censored so many pieces of it that it would be boring and meaningless to everyone. But that one, the Cliff's Notes for that one was, it was a company that we have all heard of and used their services. They're currently a private company. And just throughout the negotiation, it was one red flag after another of my client trying to negotiate, and then the company freaking out when he questioned the value of their equity, which they're private. So it's just monopoly money, basically. And just like one thing after another where the recruiter was just like basically losing his mind. And eventually my client, even though this company had offered him more money, decided just to stay put. he was like, you know what? I'm not going to go work there, because if they're treating me like that right now, I can't imagine what it's like to work there. But there's another one where I can be a little bit less vague. It was a similar story, but this is a nice little way to kind of kill two birds with one stone, because people like to ask, well, what happens like if my job offer gets rescinded when I negotiate? Mm-hmm. And my answer to that is, you know, I always tell my clients, I say, they're like, you know, if we do what you're telling me to do, are they going to rescind the offer? Like, are they going to get mad at me? And I say, listen, I can't tell you that there's a 0% chance that will happen. It's greater than zero, but it's so small, I can't even see it like on the graph. But it does happen occasionally. I think I've had, I want to say, two, maybe three clients in almost 3.5 years that this has happened to. But I had a client who was going to work for an engineering firm. He was an experienced mechanical engineer. He got a pretty compelling offer from this company, but he knew that there was room to negotiate just based on market value research and some other kind of, you know, rudimentary stuff. And up to this point, there had been a couple of interesting sort of interactions with the recruiter he was working with. This was a smaller firm, and so it wasn't, you know, it was one of those things where the recruiter had done some weird things, like kind of semi-unprofessional replies in email or you know, that kind of thing, where normally would have been kind of red flags. But I was like, you know what, this is a really small firm. Like, they probably don't have like a lot of professional recruiters, if any, in-house. This could just be like a generic HR person who's also responsible for hiring. They don't seem to have outsourced that. So, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. And then something else would happen, you know, a weird conversation with the hiring manager. Man, that's weird, but they're a small firm and they seem like good people. They're, you know, you could see their website, looks like they're doing professional work. And then eventually we got to the point where, you know, the recruiter just would not let off the gas in terms of asking for like salary expectations and stuff like that. And so eventually my client uses the, you know, well, you keep asking me for my salary expectations, but why don't you tell me what the range is that you're willing to pay for the role? And I'll tell you if that's in the ballpark, right? Which is a nice little kind of judo move I like to use. And so you're getting a range, and you're able to tell them, quote unquote, it's in the ballpark, which is not necessarily committing to that range, but it gets you past that question. Mm-hmm. So they had given him a range of salaries, and then eventually they came back and finally said, all right, we're ready to make you this offer. And this offer, again, we'd had a few red flags, and the offer was below the range. I was like, well, that's weird. And
so, that is weird.
So obviously we're going to negotiate this because they told us the range is higher than what they offered. And it's like, well, maybe they're just doing that so that we don't go blowing the range out of the water and trying for like maximum salary. And so we counter somewhere. I think the counter was actually still within the range at the higher end of the range and not even the top of the range. A very cordial counter, made a good case. I mean, this person was a really good candidate for this role. It wasn't like he was like a random candidate. And the recruiter, in response to that email that we sent, the recruiter just lost her mind. I mean, she was very frustrated that he accounted. I can't believe that you're kind of, it was like the kind of stuff where it was like, I wondered maybe if she got the wrong email, but no, it was like all threaded there in the thread. And she just said some things that were like, I can't believe you're counteroffering. This is so disrespectful. You know, they put together such a compelling counteroffer, and now I have to go tell them that you're counteroffering, and she's using quotes in the email around counteroffering. And I'm literally reading it, and I'm like, we didn't even ask for the top of the range that she told us was available. We're not like out of line here. And so, and then she said, you know what, we've decided this just isn't a good fit and we're just going to pull the offer, right? And so that was frustrating because my client had spent several weeks, you know, he went on site with them and did a bunch of work trying to get a good offer from this firm. We countered within the range they had told us was possible. And the recruiter ultimately pulled the offer despite really nothing out of line from us. But what I realized was all those red flags kind of added up to this is just a disorganized firm. It's mm-hmm. very possible that they had decided like they didn't have the budget for it anymore or something like that. But just the way it went down, like my client felt really bad. I was like, listen, I promise you that in 2 weeks, you're going to call me and tell me how glad you are you didn't go work there. And oh, yeah. 2 weeks later, he calls me. He's like, hey, I just got a much better offer at a better firm. And we want to work for them. You know, we negotiated that and we're off to the races or whatever. But it was like one of those things where it's just the classic red flag, red flag, red flag. Recruiter freaks out. And then I tell him, don't worry about it. He gets a better offer. 2 weeks later, he goes to a better firm and he lives happily ever after. But it was the sort of like, that's typically what happens when I see offers rescinded is that mm-hmm. kind of thing where it's like, there were so many red flags that we probably should have seen coming. And ultimately he's glad he didn't go work there.
That's been my experience too, is that if getting an offer rescinded isn't just one of those things that happens out of the blue, it's, mm-hmm. You will typically see it coming long before it actually happens. Much like your story of it's one red flag after another, and finally it's rescinded. And honestly, you shouldn't be that surprised they did it.
Yep. If your eyes are open, right? The red flags are usually there, and it's just a matter of, you know, are you paying attention? Yeah. And a lot of times you don't want to see those, right? Because like, if you're that far in the process, you just want to close the deal. Like you've already decided in your head that you've moved on. You're starting this new job. You're hopefully making more money. And so you're willing to kind of overlook those little foibles of the company in order to just kind of get past it. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't.
Man, that's hitting way too close to home for me. I courted a company and like they semi-courted me for years. Like I'd gone through several different interview loops with them, like spread over 3 or 4 years. And finally, the last one I did, we spent, I think, 2.5-3 weeks going through interviews, and they just kept like throwing last minute interviews at me. And I'm like, this is kind of weird. Like, I would get on the phone with someone and he'd be like, yeah, I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing here, but like someone said to go interview you. And I'm like, okay, that's odd, but sure, let's chat. And like everything was going great. Everyone loved me. I had a call from a recruiter or from the recruiter saying, hey, like, here's a verbal offer. We want to do it. And I'm like, okay, that sounds great. And then like an hour later, they rescinded the offer. And I'm like, what just happened? Like everything was going great. And like what I saw is that there was a lot of disorganization and there were red flags throughout the entire process that I wasn't paying attention to because I liked the offer so much.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that'll happen. It's easy to get blind, you know, to that sort of thing and just sort of ignore it and say, nah, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And sometimes it is fine. You know, sometimes it's your own stress. Most of the time it's fine, but sometimes it's not fine.
Yeah. Sometimes it's fine. Most of the time it's fine. Sometimes it's not. Now, something you've been saying here is this is not typical of negotiation.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm.
I found that most people don't like to negotiate, that it makes them nervous. And primarily they're afraid of the job offer being rescinded. Mm-hmm. But that's not how most negotiation goes. So what's been your experience with someone negotiating a job offer for the first time? Like, how does it actually go for them usually? Like, what's the happy path here?
Yeah, usually, I mean, it's like not even just a happy path. It's almost like a standard operating procedure, to be honest with you. I mean, I describe it as like their playbook, right? Mm-hmm. Almost always. And so this is a really fun part of my job because so many people are terrified of this, but it's literally what I do professionally. And so I go through, you know, I'm working with, I don't know, 4 or 5 clients right now. And so I'm seeing this over and over and over. And it's, like I said, it's a standard operating procedure. And so I'm able to tell my client, okay, here's what's going to happen next. It's going to, in about 12 hours, you're going to get an email. It's going to say this, and then boom, it happens. Whoa. You know? So typically here's how it goes. This is what I would say is like the 80% case. And that is, you get the offer. Sometimes it's verbal. Sometimes it's a written informal offer, almost always informal. I think a sidebar on that is I think the reason offers are so frequently informal is there's some kind of ego or metric juicing going on where it's like, companies want to be able to say that, you know, once they extend an offer, it's always accepted or something like that. And so it's like, well, technically I didn't extend an offer. I described a verbal offer to you. Or I described an informal offer somewhere.
That's a nice gaming of the system.
I think it is. I don't have any like data or confirmation on that, but that's sure what it feels like. And so you rarely will just get a formal like offer letter that you just have to sign. First, you will get a verbal offer or an email with some bullet points or something number, something, how do you feel about this, that kind of stuff. And so the first thing I'll do is have my client make sure that they get something in writing, even if, you know, they just say, hey, thanks so much for the offer. I appreciate it. Would you mind just sending me the, you know, bullet point summary and email just so I can make sure I didn't miss anything? And so you're just trying to head off any potential future miscommunications there. Is why I do that. It's never happened that somebody misunderstood an offer, but it helps to make, you just want to be positive, because the next thing we're going to do is send a counteroffer email. Typically that email will also have what I call the why I'm awesome paragraph in it. And it's a description of why this person is such a good fit for this particular role, this particular company. I do that for two reasons. One is to make the counter offer have a little bit more weight to it, but also to make sort of a document that can be circulated internally if they need to get approvals. And I've had clients come back to me and say, hey, just so you know, my recruiter told me that email with that paragraph literally got me another $10,000 because it went through finance and they approved. So we'll send that counter offer email. Typically the recruiter will get the counter offer email and within 12 to 24 hours, business hours, they'll respond and say, hey, thanks for considering our offer. I wonder if you have some time to chat about this sometime soon. So they're trying to move out of email and onto the phone. Mm-hmm. And so then what I'll do with my clients is say, okay, well, tell them, you know, you're not available until tomorrow afternoon. Then I'll create a script for them. The script is designed to give them the next moves that they can make based on how the company responds to their counteroffer. So the company made an offer. Let's say the offer is 150K base and we countered it, let's say 170K base. And so now the first thing we'll do is talk about salaries between 150 and 170K to see, you know, what if they come back at 160K? What are we going to say? What if they're at 165? What are we going to say? What if they don't come off of 150? What are we going to say? And so I'll have a little script for them that's basically just a way for them to kind of hone in on whatever the recruiter says in response and then make sure that they ask for the next few things that make sense. So for example, in my example, if they were at 150 and they came up to 155, I think there's probably room there to ask for a little more salary. We might ask for 160. And then if they say no, or they give a partial yes, so they don't come all the way up to whatever we ask for, which is kind of what I'm shooting for, by the way, then we'll ask for the next thing. Okay, well, you offered 20,000 equity. Can you do 30,000 equity? No or partial yes, we'll move on to the next thing and say, yeah, well, you gave me 25,000 equity. That's great. Can you add a $10,000 sign-on bonus and I'm on board? And so we're prepping for that and rehearsing that sometimes, depending on if the client wants to do that, so that when the recruiter calls them and they have this conversation where the recruiter says, hey, you know, we offered you 150, you asked for 170, we can't do that, that's above our budget, but we can do 155. How do you feel about that? And then you know exactly what to say. So once that call is over, usually that's basically the end of the negotiation. Either the recruiter will have said, I'm authorized to do XYZ, how's that feel? And the candidate will say yes. Or the recruiter will say, I think I might be able to do that. Let me go talk to the comp team and see what they say. And then it'll wrap up and they talk start date. So that's the kind of straightforward, very vanilla, easy mm-hmm. mode version. That's about 80% of the time.
Yeah, it's incredible how scripted and prepared mm-hmm. that all is. And
yes,
pretty much every job offer I approached until I learned that, you know, recruiters are always better at this than I am, mm-hmm. was, oh, well, I'll just kind of wing it.
Yeah.
And then one day I realized, wait a minute, the people I'm negotiating against do this for a living. Like they're doing this several times a day and I do this once every 2 years. Maybe I should be more prepared.
Yeah. That's what it's all about is being prepared for what comes next. So that's a lot of what I do with clients to say, you know, we'll ideate through different scenarios that might happen. Right. And the scariest one and the one where people most become scared and also try to wing it is on that phone call where, you know, 80% of the negotiation is just sending that counteroffer. If you can just do it and you do it tactfully, then you've done most of the work. But there's still that 20% where you can get another 5K salary, you can get another 20K equity, and that can happen on that phone call. But the problem is that because you do it so rarely, as soon as you hear them go, "Hey, Mike, how's it going?" and then you freeze up and you go, "Oh no," and then you don't say the right thing. So, like, I mean, I when I invented the script that I used, it was on my whiteboard in my office, which Mike, you can see it over my shoulder, and I had scripted it out. And the recruiter said something to me and I started to respond by asking for more vacation time. And then I glanced up at my whiteboard and realized that's not what it says. And so I said, wait, forget what I just said. And she kind of chuckled. I said, if you can do, I don't know, with the 118,000, then I'm on board. And she said, all right, you know? And so like, I almost just left money out there. I wrote about this in my book. Mm-hmm. Because I had the script, I had invented the script. I'm the inventor of this script. I am a salary negotiation expert. I wasn't at the time, but I was kind of, you know, still ahead of most people because I was doing it for the third time maybe. And I almost messed it up on this live phone call, even though I had planned about it and written the script out because I wasn't physically looking at the script when the recruiter spoke to me, I almost messed it up. And so it's a question of adrenaline and experience, you know,
right.
You just don't have a lot to call on and things are happening really quickly. That phone call is 2 or 3 minutes long, usually at most. Mm-hmm. So it's super stressful and we make mistakes under stress.
It is a very stressful, very short phone call. Like every single time I've done it, it's 5 minutes.
But,
oh man, it feels like way longer.
Oh, it's exhausting. It's one of those, you hang up the phone, you sit down and go, like, let out a sigh and go, okay, what just happened?
You know? I remember I had this happen. I had this happen some years ago. I was working for a company making 50,000. And I was going through this interview with a new company and I hadn't told them what I was making. I was very careful about that, but I was still kind of winging it. Like I still hadn't really prepared. And I got a text from the hiring manager and said, "Hey, I want to make you an offer for 90K. And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, this is amazing."
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I ask him, like, "That sounds good. What's the title on that?" He goes, "Oh, it's like this junior systems engineer." Well, I knew he had a senior position also. I'm like, I want that senior role. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Oh, well, the salary for that is 120. I'm like, "Okay, that's good. I'll take that."
Sounds good.
Yeah. So like that was the extent of my negotiation. I'm like, "Oh my God, I just did what now?" And like, I did this over text.
Uh-huh.
And I still hadn't prepared, but it was very much like I was lucky to do it. It was luck that played out, not my preparation.
Yeah. Well, I'll push back a little bit on that. So yeah, I kind of agree, but just the fact that you knew that there was a senior role available and had the wherewithal to ask about it.
That's true.
That's not luck, right? That's preparation.
Yeah, that is true.
Most people wouldn't have thought about that. Yeah.
Right.
So I mean, that's, you know, sometimes it works out that way, but I think you were prepared a little bit more than you gave yourself credit for there.
That's fair. So we've been talking sort of about some pitfalls that people run into. What are three of the biggest mistakes that you see people run into when they're doing a job negotiation?
You mentioned one of them just a second ago, and I said good job, and that is they share either salary history or salary expectations. Mm-hmm. And kind of briefly, this is a soapbox that I've been on for a couple of years now, but there's reasons that you don't want to share either of those. The salary history, the main reason that you don't want to share that is really what you want to do in the interview process and as you're getting an offer is you want to cause the company to think, what do we have to do to convince this person to join our team? The problem is with the giving them salary history is you've changed that from what do we have to do to convince him to join our team to what's the minimum that we have to do to convince him to join our team, which is usually like your current salary plus 5% or 3% or something.
Right.
And so I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this right now and they realize now, oh, I did that. And what happened was, you know, how much are you making right now? I'm making $80,000. And then, you know, 3 weeks later you get a job offer and it's $85,000. I'm like, oh, wow, it's just a smidge higher than what I'm currently making. What a coincidence. What are the odds? And the odds are zero, like that it's a coincidence, right? That's very much, they just said, well, he's making 80, we'll offer him 85 and see if he'll bite.
Yep.
On the flip side of that, the salary expectations questions is also pretty dangerous. People's intuition on this is, well, I need to say a big number. That if you're going to say a number, bigger is better, for the most part, you know, within reason. But the reason that I don't advocate sharing that number, is really, it's easier to understand how I feel about that if I reframe the question as follows. I just did this with a client the other day and he said, oh, so instead of what are you hoping to make if we hire you in this role? If they said, you know, we're a pretty big company. We've got 10,000 employees. We've got a whole army of people doing data analysis, and we get salary surveys every month from four different firms, and we pretty much know what the market is paying. We have 17 people who do the job that we're hiring you to do, and they've all been here for about 5 years, and you know, we can pretty much dial into the penny how much they should be paid. So given all that, what's your best guess what we might pay somebody with your skill set to do the job that we're thinking about hiring you for? And the answer should be a big, you know, my favorite little emoticon thing is the shruggy guy. The shruggy guy, and you say, oh, I don't know, right? And so what they're doing is asking you to guess at what their pay structures are and mm-hmm. what their budget is and all this stuff. And you just don't know that stuff. And so you're either going to miss under, which is bad because you probably cost yourself money. You know, you say 80,000 and they're thinking, we would have gone as high as 95. And there goes $15,000 that you never knew you had.
Yep.
Or you say a number that's way too big. You say 120 and they were hoping for 95 and they go, we can't afford Mike. You know, I was really hoping that we could bring him on, but maybe we should just move on to other candidates. And so that may sound nice because it saves people time, but the problem is that you've missed the opportunity that you so clearly articulated, which is, well, but what if through the interviews, if they didn't know what your expectations were, you had a chance to convince them that you are worth what your expectations are,
right?
So maybe they started at 95 budget for like a mid-level engineer, but they talk to you six times in interviews and bring you on site and put you on the whiteboard and all this other stuff, give you a take-home project. And you come back and they're like, well, we were looking at it for mid-level engineer, but I think we should probably offer this as a senior. And maybe we need to up the budget for that, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're able to talk them into that. You don't have that opportunity if you disqualify yourself by just being out of range initially. So that's the big, that's number one with a bullet asterisk next to it. It's underlined explanation points. That's the mistake that almost everyone makes. And it warms my heart anytime I talk to a new client and they're like, hey, I read your stuff on not sharing salary expectations. So I haven't done that. I'm like, yes,
awesome.
Because it's going to be easier for us and we're going to make you more money. So that's a big one. The second one is, I would say not negotiating at all. A lot of people, you know, I feel like in my world, it's crazy not to negotiate because that's all sure. I think about. But most people still almost, it doesn't even occur to them to negotiate. And I know this because so many of my clients come to me and they say, well, I got the offer and I was thinking about how to respond. And then I thought, maybe I should negotiate this. And so I started Googling salary negotiation stuff and I ran into you.
Almost like it's an afterthought.
It is an afterthought for them. And for those, for, you know, for every one of those people, there's 50 people that it never occurred to them mm-hmm. until maybe they were already working at the job and they had lunch with somebody one day and realized that person was making 10,000 more than them and there was available.
Yeah.
So just not even negotiating, which sounds, I don't know, it's not a very meaty answer, but I mean, if I don't know what the number is, but I'm guessing, you know, less than half of people even consider negotiating, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people who are just not even trying. And then I'd say the third one is kind of giving up too easily. I mentioned, you know, before in my, you know, 80%, this is the straight line, how it usually goes. Even if they come back and they say, you know, you asked for 170 and we offered you 150 and our budget was 150. And people go, oh, okay, well, I don't want to lose the job, so I'll take 150. When what they should say is, are you sure you can't get to 160? Or, well, what can you do? Or, okay, well, let's talk about the equity, right? Maybe you have some flexibility there. Or you didn't mention a sign-on bonus. Can you do a $10,000 sign-on bonus? So like there's opportunity there. Even if you feel like you hit a wall, there's probably opportunity to ask for something else, to find something else where they're flexible by either directly just saying, well, you're not flexible on salary. Is there anything else that we could talk about here? Is there anything else that you can give on or ask for something? And so giving up too early can be pretty expensive. And that's one of those things where, you know, the story that person would usually tell is, oh, well, I did counteroffer, but they said they couldn't move. But what they're really mean is they said they couldn't move on base salary and I didn't press them on anything else. And so usually when you're that deep in the process, you have enough, you know, kind of capital built up with them in terms of how badly they want to fill the role that asking for equity or a sign-on bonus is, they'll just shrug it off. If it's something they can't do, they'll say, oh, no, we can't do that either. But they might say, yeah, here's another 5,000 shares or here's $10,000 for sign-on bonus or we'll do a relocation for you. So that would be the third one.
Okay. Yeah. You started to talk a bit about those of there's salary is not just the only lever you can pull.
Right.
You could pull equity. You can pull stock grants. You can pull vacation time, remote mm-hmm. work. Like there's so many different levers you can pull to increase your total comp.
Yes.
And it's and like the levers are interdependent in some ways, but not as closely tied as people often think.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times, you know, so it really varies by firm, but some firms like Google, for example, Amazon does this too. They're not very flexible on base salary, but they can be very flexible on equity mm-hmm. for the right candidates, right? Amazon especially will do this because of their weird vesting schedule. So there are other levers that you can pull, and you can't know whether they're, you know, fixed levers or variable levers until you ask about them.
Right.
So yeah, there are things that are not just salary. I tend to have my clients tell me, you know, what are the two or three things you care the most about? Either that are explicitly in the offer. So most offers that I see, because I work with engineers, most offers look like some combination of base salary, equity, sign-on bonus. And sometimes that sign-on bonus is a zero, but it's almost always available if asked for. Mm-hmm. And so I'll ask them to, you know, just so I'm clear, I assume that base salary is most important to you, followed by equity funding, followed by a sign-on bonus. Correct me if I'm wrong. And sometimes they'll say, actually, you know, I'd rather focus on the equity in this case. And I say, great, you know, I'm hoping for a moonshot here. The salary's already good enough. Let's get more equity. But we'll talk about that in terms of, you know, what are your two or three or four most important things? And then we'll build a strategy that allows us to essentially piecemeal maximize each one of those in turn and in sequence until we get to the end of the training. We can say, okay, now we've maximized the offer in terms of base equity sign-on bonus. We feel pretty good about it.
I want to talk about that sign-on bonus for a bit because it's not super common in the world of DevOps and SRE for sign-on bonuses, much more common in software engineering roles. But mm-hmm. like what's a normal sign-on bonus at, say, a normal firm? Like, are we talking in the realm of $2,000? Are we talking $50,000, more, less?
Yeah, I would say it depends on which firm. There are a lot of variables here, but I would say I almost never ask for a sign-on bonus less than $10,000. And I've seen sign-ons that are in the six figures. For specific engineers, maybe not DevOps or SREs, but more for like, you know, machine learning specialists, automation specialists, mm-hmm. AI. But for most experienced engineers, most firms have a kind of a little bucket of one-time cash sitting around that they'll dole out a little bit of if for the right candidate. So I would think, especially for your audience, I'm guessing, you know, $10,000 is a reasonable amount of a sign-on bonus. To certainly fish for,
yeah.
To see if it's available.
Yeah, it's a matter of calibration because they're not very common. Like what's a reasonable number here? Like what's possible is really the question.
Yeah, and so a lot of times what I'm hoping is that the company will give us something to key on. So there's a lot of little subtle things that are happening with my strategy. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that I like to counter on base salary first. One reason I'm doing that is to get more base salary. But another reason is that I actually want to see how flexible they are on different stuff. And so sometimes they'll come back because the base salary is more than they can budget, which is sort of by design. I'm intentionally asking for more base salary than I think they can give by a little bit. What I want them to do is move a little on base and then move on some other dimensions like equity or a sign-on bonus or something so that I can see how much they move or what they offer. So if we counter with, you know, $30,000 more base salary and they can only do 15, maybe they'll throw in a $25,000 signing bonus. And now I have a kind of a baseline to use when I'm talking about sign-on bonus with them. That, so I try to get them to tell me first. And if they don't, then I usually start by keying off of, if I can find information online, I'll use that on Pesa or Glassdoor or something. Mm-hmm. But I usually just key off of, well, about how much gap in base salary did we ask for that is kind of unfulfilled. That's usually kind of my guide for how much of a signing bonus to ask for. So we asked for 30K base, we got 15. There's $15,000 we need to try and come up with somewhere that's a coherent story. And so I might end up asking for a $15,000 or $20,000 sign-on bonus in that range.
Sure. So we've been talking a lot about new jobs, new job negotiation. There's a lot of people out there who actually really like the job they have, but are feeling underpaid in. Like maybe they've been there for 15 years and but they really like the place. They don't want to leave, but they just want more money. What can they do?
Well, they can forget everything that we just talked about. it's a totally different process.
All right,
so
then.
I'll start by saying that, you know, this is a process that I developed as a hiring manager when I had a team of people who were all underpaid when I took over the team. And just in case, and on the off chance any of those people happen to be listening, they were underpaid just through inertia, through time that passes in firms, kind of like you said. Mm-hmm. This was not a 15-year-old firm, but they'd all been doing their jobs for 2 or 3 years and had been really good at them and had been essentially promoted into these jobs that were more demanding, and the salary just hadn't caught up. And so they came to me and said, hey, you know, when I hired in, I thought I was going to get this kind of a raise over time and my salary just hasn't tracked with it. I said, great, here's what I need from you. And so what I told them I need from them is what I have written a course on and that I teach people. I wrote about it in my book. And that's this. So first they need to do some research and market value estimation to figure out, okay, well, I've been in the firm for 15 years. I know I'm definitely behind the pay curve, but how far behind am I? What should I be making right now, given my skill set, experience, and my value to this firm? And figure that number out. So that's what I call your target salary. And so they need to go in with a number. So this is totally different. That's why I said, forget everything we just talked about. Mm-hmm. In the new job offer, we want the company to say the first number because we don't know what their scale looks like. In the current job situation, we do know what the scale looks like because I know my salary. And so, and they know my salary. And so you have to basically present everything to your manager on a silver platter to make it as easy as possible for them just to rubber stamp your request and go to finance and see if they'll approve it. And so the first thing you want, there are three things that you need. The first one is a target salary. That's based on the research that I mentioned. You want to do as good a job as you can and come up with a number that is reasonable and makes sense given your tenure, the value of the company. And you want to try and tie that to your actual work product. The second thing is accomplishments. So this is how you demonstrate the value that you're asking for. And so the way I describe raises is, see if I can get this right. I haven't said this out loud in a while, but it's you're asking for compensation for the unexpected value that you're adding since the last time your salary was set. So the key word in that phrase is unexpected value. And so it's like, for whatever reason, your salary was set 15 years ago, you're now producing significantly more value than you were when we set that salary. And some of that value is unexpected. You accelerated faster, or it's unexpected because you're just not being compensated for it because we didn't do raises 5 years in a row during the recession or whatever that was, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's asking to be compensated for the unexpected value that you're adding since the last time your salary was set. And so you want to be able to say, well, here's what I think I should be making. Here's what I would like. I would like $120,000 base salary. So you're a specific ask. And the reason I'm asking for that is I'm actually managing twice the business that we expected me to be managing at this point. I've been mentoring 6 people. And I've also taken a lot of the responsibility that you, my manager, does onto my plate in terms of reporting and getting things ready for roll-ups so that you don't have to do that work and you can focus on more valuable work, which saves the firm a lot of money and time. And so you're justifying your ask. And the third thing is I call accolades, other people having recognized what you're doing. And so that's a client who sent you a gift card because they loved your work. That's a coworker who wrote you an email and said, thanks for saving my bacon. That's your manager sending you an email and identifying that you're a superstar and that you're crushing it this year and hope we have a good time next year, whatever that is. And so you package those all together. The way that I like to do this is to have my clients write an email. And it's going to be sent to the manager later. But the idea is that if you can't write this email, then you've got problems. Mm-hmm. There's something missing. If you can't figure out the target salary, your manager can't figure it out either. If you can't back up your request with accomplishments, there's something wrong here. You're asking for more money, but for no reason. If you don't have any accolades, that's optional, but that can sometimes be a red flag because it's like, well, nobody has recognized the work you're doing. That's probably not good, but that's optional. And so you package it up into this email. I'll send you a link to the template after we talk. And You get it ready, you rehearse it, and then you ask your manager if they have time to talk about getting a raise. You tell them, I'd like to talk about my compensation in our next one-on-one. You talk to them, you basically verbally present the case that I just described. And then after that conversation, you follow up and say, hey, just wanted to follow up with an email summary of our conversation today about my raise request. Here's a summary of what I'm asking for. And you send them that email. Again, this is a document that can be circulated, and that's why you do it. So they can just rubber stamp it and say, yep, looks good to me. Hey, finance, can you do 120 for Josh? Yes, great, let's do it. Or no, the best we can do is 110 or whatever. And you, now the conversation is rolling.
Yep.
So in a nutshell, as a manager, that's the process I developed, and that's the process that I teach people when they ask.
Man, that's fantastic advice. Coming from the other side of the table, I know there are things that managers must be doing wrong in negotiation with candidates. Like they're losing great people. What advice would you have for the managers that are listening on how to improve negotiation with a candidate?
Yeah, it's almost not even negotiation advice. You kind of mentioned what it is. I mean, employee attrition is very expensive. If somebody leaves because they feel like they're undervalued or underpaid, that can be a really expensive thing to happen to a firm when that person would be better there, when they need that person to do the work they're doing. And so I think that maybe a big mistake that managers make with this stuff is they think they're really busy and there's a lot going on. And yeah, this person's mentioned a couple times they're a little frustrated with their pay, but I'll just deal with that later. I'll just kick the can down the road. I'll wait until it's a slower period. I'll wait until the end of the quarter or whatever that is. And I think that's a mistake just because it takes a lot of courage for an employee to go to their manager and say, hey, I know you're paying me well, but I'd like to be paid better. Or I know you're paying me a paycheck every 2 weeks. I want that paycheck to be bigger. It's intimidating. And most people will not even do it. They just won't. And so if you're a manager and somebody comes to you and says, I'd like to talk about my pay, you should perk up and listen. That's significant. They're overcoming a lot of inertia to do that, to have that conversation, to say that thing to you. And there's a really good chance that before that conversation, they've already started looking for jobs somewhere else.
Yeah, they've probably been thinking about this for months by the time they work the courage up.
Yep, they've been talking about it, you know, over happy hour on Friday. It comes up every Friday. They've been complaining about it. Somebody finally said, why don't you talk to your boss? And they finally did, but it's after months. And maybe after they've sent their resume out to a couple of firms. Maybe after they changed their status on LinkedIn to say looking for work. So if you care at all about having that employee on your team, if they have the courage to talk to you, you should sit up and listen and say, how can I help? Right. And actively work with them to help. If they do present a case like this to you, give them real feedback on it. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's the timing on what we're going to do. Let me know if that works for you. Here's how I'm going to help you through this process. Here's what else I need from you. Here's what I think the timing will look like. Communicate clearly with them. So number one, don't blow off their request. Don't kick the can down the road. That could be a big mistake that it results in you getting a 2 weeks notice a couple days later. Two, communicate with them openly. Tell them what you need from them. If you know what the process looks like to get raises approved and things, tell them, this is what I need from you to get this done. Be open with them about it. And keep them posted on the process. And the last thing I would say is, if that person has come to you and asked for a raise that made their case in the way I described, and you disagree with their case, say, okay, I hear what you're asking for, but I just don't think you're quite ready for that yet. Not only should you share that with them, but you should also say, and here's what you can do to get the raise that you just asked me for. Here's what I need to see from you performance-wise to justify this when I go to finance. And I think that'll take 6 months. Here are the discrete steps that you need to take. And if you accomplish those things, I think that I can make a good enough case to get you a raise, and we'll follow up on this in our next one-on-one. So those are the three things I would say that managers should be thinking about.
All right, then. Well, Josh, this has been just a fantastic time. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
The easiest place to find me, actually to interact with me, is probably Twitter. I'm at Josh Duty on Twitter. Super active on there. If you mention me, I'll reply. Most of my salary negotiation work, including my coaching offering and all that good stuff, is on my website, fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. There's all kinds of free material there. I've made a ton of free stuff available. If you want to learn more about the coaching that I mentioned, that's fearlesssalarynegotiation.com/coach. Those are the three things I would say are probably the most useful and directly useful to your audience.
Yeah, and you wrote a book called Fearless Salary Negotiation, which I've had the pleasure of reading, and it's absolutely fantastic. I love it. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for saying that.
It's one of those books I wish that I had read just years ago when I first started this. I shudder to think about how much money I've left on the table as a result of not having had that.
That's why I wrote it. That's very kind of you to say. Thank you for saying that.
I've been sending all of my friends to you for negotiation and such. The work you're doing is fantastic. So thank you so much for joining me.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a really good talk and fun to talk to you face-to-face. Yep. For the first time in a while.
So to all the listeners, thank you for listening to the Real World DevOps podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcast. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.